Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. This is Simon Brew, and a very warm welcome to the Film Stories Podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, well, title gives it away, really. I'm here to talk off the stories of film, and I tend to talk about development stories, marketing stories, production stories, release stories, all the bits and bobs, really, that go to make the films that we know and love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. Now, the films I tend to cover on this podcast have more of a mainstream leaning to them than anything else. They're certainly films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try not to punch down. I try not to do snot. I'm just here to celebrate cinema, the fact that it exists, the fact that films are really difficult to make, and I love the fact that people manage to make them. Without further ado and preamble, I'm going to get on with the first of the two films I'm talking about in this episode of Film Stories. And it'd be fair to say this one is pretty much a modern classic. Let me play you a clip and I'll come to the story the other side of this.
Mysterious things have been happening all over town.
We're rich again.
I may look like a hardened criminal, but I'm innocent.
We're going to need a foolproof plan.
If anyone can recognize a criminal, it's us.
He's a master of disguise.
What? This is breaking and entering.
I haven't broken anything.
Where do you think you're going, Bear?
Paddington wouldn't hesitate if any of us needed help.
He looks for the good in all of us.
Oh. Ah!
Marmalade?
Oh! Take a seat.
That then was a clip from the wonderful Paddington 2, directed by Paul King, written by King and Simon Farnaby, and based on the Paddington Bear books by Michael Bond. The cast for this one, led by Hugh Bonneville, Sally Hawkins, Brendan Gleeson, Julie Walters, Jim Broadbent, Peter Capaldi, Hugh Grant, and Ben Whishaw as the voice of the bear. And so the story of Paddington 2 inevitably goes back to the first Paddington movie that came out in 2014. And it had been a gamble of a movie, that was. That Studio Canal was the company behind it. And it had invested some $40 to $50 million in the production of the film, which is not really the kind of amount Studio Canal was spending on an individual film. It was quite a stretch for the company to take a punt on something like this. But then there was confidence in the character. There was confidence in the Michael Bond stories of Paddington. And there hadn't been a film before. There'd been a little bit of reluctance there, perhaps from Michael Bond, just to sell the rights in the first place. And so the first Paddington coming together was quite an adventure. And it turned into, of course, a real triumph. It wasn't without the odd little production hiccup. I think it's pretty well known that Colin Firth was originally cast as the voice of Paddington Bear and was replaced in post-production quite amicably. Ben Whishaw was brought in, and the movie proved to be an absolute triumph. At that point, it was the highest grossing family film by a non-US studio. And whilst it wasn't doing the numbers of big Disney movies or big DreamWorks movies or films of that ilk, it was a very loved movie and had made a comfortable return for Studio Canal and the producer David Heyman, who had been one of those key to shepherding the film to the screen. Now, Heyman had had form with family movies, having produced the Harry Potter series. And it was he that confirmed, although it wasn't much of a secret, the plans for a follow-up in the autumn of 2015. That's when the news first was talked about properly. Heyman was complimentary about the freedom Studio Canal had given him on the original film, but at this stage there was a sticking point that Paul King wasn't sure, and so at least hadn't committed to returning to make another Paddington film. A man wary of sequels, he would ultimately take his time before committing to the movie, and when he did, he drafted in a bit of extra help, because one of the people involved in the first film, who's in it and also provided some writing support, was Simon Farnaby, part of the Horrible Histories and Ghosts crew, also the writer of films like Mindhorn and the recent The Phantom of the Open. And so King invited him to take the step up to co-writer position on Paddington 2, and Farnaby would accept that. And he admitted in Junkies, I spoke to him for the excellent The Phantom of the Open, and he said that working with King on Paddington 2 was a schooling and a half in how to write a screenplay. There's a special Film Stories podcast episode with Simon Farnaby a few months back where we talk about this. Now, one of the reasons King had been umming and ahhing about whether to return to the world of Paddington wasn't just a slight concern over sequels, but also he'd reportedly been offered the directorial reins of the 2017 movie Wonder, based on the book by R.J. Palacio, that would ultimately be directed by Stephen Chbosky and star Julia Roberts and Owen Wilson. And Wonder would turn into a delightful film. I've covered that previously on the Film Stories podcast. But King would decline that opportunity and instead would return to the world of Paddington. And the confirmation that he was back came in April of 2015. That's when he committed, or at least it was reported he committed to the film. And he brought with him the inevitable ambition of a sequel. Now, Studio Canal isn't a traditional Hollywood major. It's not based in Hollywood for a start. And so the old sequel rules of you have to go bigger and more expensive and more expansive didn't necessarily have to apply. But there was inevitable ambition with the sequel here, that they did want to make it a little bit bigger, but they didn't want to go mad. They wanted to keep and contain what they captured in the first film. They also wanted to just try things that they weren't able to do first time around. So with the encouragement of David Heyman, King and Farnaby were letting their imaginations run riot, that they were sticking close to the Michael Bond books, but also they were dreaming up, for instance, a train sequence that they just felt as they were writing it. This is going to be tricky. Can we actually get away with it? Can we afford this? But with the encouragement of David Heyman, they put it all down, not really sure how it was going to work, but that would be a problem to be solved later on. There was reportedly a little bit of a writing room to this as well, that is something that's familiar to people who work in television, less so in film. But King had been part of the Mighty Boosh TV show, and whilst they were putting Paddington 2 together, an assortment of writers came in and just gave input. In fact, if you read the end credits of the movie, there are a lot of people who get special thanks, and the names that you'll spot in there are familiar, particularly to fans of British comedy shows. Lawrence Rickard, Ben Wilbond and Jim Howick are all part of the Horrible Histories gang, for instance. Samantha Ellis, Sam Bain, Julian Barrett in there, James Serenovich and Alex Kirk. Just some of the people who are cited in there. And so whilst it was King and Farnaby's script, and there's no doubt it was King and Farnaby's script, they were open to ideas and they were inviting ideas as they put their screenplay together. Now, the screenplay was getting slightly more ambitious and the film was going to cost a little bit more than the first, but still still a relatively modest, by the scale of what they put on screen, $40 million production budget. And so it was in October 2016, a year after we'd officially learned that Paul King was going to return to direct, that Paddington 2 was ready to go. And at this point, it was confirmed that the cast, the cast from the first film were back. Hugh Bonneville, Julie Walters, Imelda Staunton, Jim Broadbent, Peter Capaldi, and of course, Ben Whishaw lending his voice to Paddington as well. But then we'd learnt of some new additions to the lineup as well. And it would be fair to say that these additions to the cast only enhanced the film that we got. So, for instance, Sanjeev Bhaskar signed on the dotted line, Ben Miller, Jessica Hines as well. And then I'd argue the two highest profile additions to the Paddington 2 cast were Brendan Gleeson playing a character by the name of Knuckles McGinty. I remember he did an interview with the Kermode and Mayo Film Review programme where he admitted, as when he was asked about that character name ahead of production, that yes, there might be a slight villainous edge to that. They might be onto something there. And then Hugh Grant came in, cast as Phoenix Buchanan, a character that was described as a fated thespian. And Grant, at this stage in his career, was having a little bit of a revival, that his film work had kind of spluttered a little bit, and he'd admitted he sort of lost interest a little bit in film acting. But then he took on a role in the film Florence Foster Jenkins, opposite Meryl Streep and directed by Stephen Frears. And that got him some of the best reviews he'd had in a movie, certainly for a long time at that point. Now, he'd gone on to do television work as well that had been acclaimed, but him joining the ensemble of Paddington 2 would turn out to be something of a masterstroke for him and also for the filmmakers. Now, while all this cast was coming together, the crew of the film were just working out how they were going to do some of the complex things that had been built into the screenplay. Because that aforementioned train chase, well, that was going ahead. They'd got the green light to do it. They'd got the budget to do it as well. And that meant the pressure was on the shoulders of production designer Gary Williamson and his team. Because how do you film an exciting train chase when your budget's $40 million, you're shooting in the UK? And the answer to that was you go along to Leavesden Studios, just outside of London. That's where the Harry Potter studio tour is. And you put train tracks down on the studio floor and you go to shoot the sequence for real. Because while there's are clearly extensive CG elements to Paddington 2, Paul King wanted proper steam trains for his big finale. And that's exactly what they were going to use. And so it got to a point where the start of production was announced for October the 18th, 2016. And as is the modern way with such films, a press release was issued announcing that filming had begun. This press release also confirmed that the release date of the movie was going to be 13 months away, 10th of November 2017. Now, tellingly, there were only release dates issued in a few countries, but then Studio Canal, which had fully developed and financed the movie and confirmed it was fully financing the movie, was only going to distribute it in the UK, France, Germany, Australia and New Zealand. And it was going to be handling sales rights to territories elsewhere around the world. And so the American rights to Paddington 2, and we're going to come back to this towards the end of the story, would sell to the Weinstein Company, that Studio Canal would not release the film in the States, and thus a US release date couldn't be announced at that point. So work got underway. And I mean, Sally Hawkins, for one, she reportedly flew in straight from the Canadian shoot of a film from Guillermo del Toro, The Shape of Water. Remember that? A film where she'd been working on a drenched set and was looking forward to a film where she could be in the dry a bit more. Let's just say in Paddington 2, she ends up battling a bit of water again. The shoot also, I mean, clearly it was an upbeat one. Hugh Grant was said, for one, to be having a ball, that he fully leaned into this character that was being created for in Phoenix Buchanan, to the point where the set was decorated with pictures of Grant in his previous roles to fill in some of the backstory. Whenever we see Buchanan in his quarters surrounded by pictures of himself, they are, of course, pictures of Hugh Grant from his previous films. He was leaning into his reputation a little bit and clearly having a blast with it all. But let's go to that train for a minute, because they brought in a Belmont British Pullman train. Now, I'm not a locomotive expert, but let's just say that is not a small train to pull into a movie studio. And so it had to be brought to the set on a truck, was operated by remote control. And for Paul King, it was just amazing to have this on set. For David Heyman, who produced the Harry Potter films, he was used to huge sets. He was used to huge set pieces on family movies. But as Paul King would describe, he said, in David's universe, we're comparatively small potatoes. And King would say, I'd often go, look at this set. It's amazing. And then remember, it's about the size of Harry Potter's bathroom. Now, I'd mentioned just before that there were elements from the first film that they tried to bring into the second, and one was a hugely tricky sequence involving a pop-up book taking us in and around the city of London. Now, this had been designed originally, or conceived at least, for the first film, but at that stage they couldn't really make it work in the budget of that movie or also in the schedule of it. If you've not seen the movie, I don't want to spoil it. Let's just say it involves a CG pop-up book that integrates wonderfully with live action. It's a really incredible visual sequence, but also a hugely difficult one to put together. And so, I mean, the logistics of this had to be put together relatively early. That, again, Gary Williamson and his team needed to sort those logistics, not least because the effects wizards at Framestore in London needed to design it. Now, Glenn Pratt was the film's visual supervisor. He was the effects guru on this, he and his team. And the job landed on his plate. They got together footage of a number of London landmarks to weave that in. And, I mean, it just had to work, because one of the things that King and Farnaby had done in their screenplay is they had made it integral, that it was an easy sequence to cut in the first movie because it wasn't quite as woven into the plot. This time they'd written it deliberately and heavily into the plot. This had to work. There was no room for error on it. Clearly then, Paddington 2 was a union of the physical work that was going on set at Leavesden and also the effects work that was taking place in Framestore. And there were some complex sequences that had to be knitted really well together. And so sometimes with CG-heavy films, or where there's a CG character in there, filmmakers have been known to put ping pong balls on the end of sticks just so actors on set in live action can get their eye line. What Paul King did was he enlisted the services of Javier Marzan, a physical performer who would come in and act out some of the moves for Paddington on set in the movie to give people something to react against, but also it helped Framestore when they had to animate Paddington into those sequences later on. It's not as if the writing had dialed down on what they could do. I mean, Simon Farnaby would say we had a lot of fun bashing the sequences out. He said the barbershop sequence, I'm going to come to that later, was one of the hardest we had to do, but they were putting some relatively complex stuff that needed to be shot into the movie, and it was one of those cases where there wasn't really much room for error on it. If they were going to do it, they had to commit to it and do it really, really well. And that's not to say they skimped on the physical side of it either. I mean, there's a wonderful post-credit prison dance sequence. You know it if you've seen it, that Craig Revel Horwood was brought in to choreograph. And it was a long shoot as well, that the photography on the movie only ended on the 27th of June 2017. And that's, you know what, I mean, looking at it, that's 8-9 months after the first shot was in the can. So it wasn't consistently shooting for all of that time, but that was the point where the last shot was captured. And in a bittersweet note, on the last day of filming, the cast, crew and the world got the news that Michael Bond had passed away. In his 90s, he'd lived to see how loved the first Paddington movie was. He would never get to see the response to the second and to see the love and joy that his creation would continue to bring to the world. And I mean, the response to the second, I mean, no spoiler here, it was going to be quite something. So into post-production, and on paper it looked like quite a short post-production period, that the last shots were in the can in June, the film would premiere in November, but of course the work had been going on at Framestore continually throughout the shoot of the movie. And Paul King was someone who was checking the footage coming from Framestore on a daily basis. When they came to animate Paddington and put the character of Paddington into the film, Ben Whishaw, of course, providing the voice, but also they used his facial expressions for reference as well. It was Pablo Grillo, who's the animation director on the movie. And he was, I mean, they'd got the first film under their belt. They knew they could realise this character on screen. They also knew that Paddington had to do more complex stuff in the second film. If you consider the logistics of putting an animated character into, again, that aforementioned train sequence, the size of the challenge is quite something there. Now, the final cut of Paddington 2 comes in at a lean 104 minutes in the end, including credits. But there was a point where Paul King and his team felt that it was potentially just running a little bit too long. Jonathan Amos and Mark Everson were his editors on this. And Alice Lowe told a story on Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast about that aforementioned film's barbershop sequence that Alice Lowe knew Paul King. And in post-production, King was umming and ahhing about whether to include the barbershop sequence in the film at all, that there were fears that at this stage the film wasn't quite tight enough. And was that sequence actually adding anything? Had it earned its place narratively in the movie? And so what King did was he brought Alice Lowe in, and for all I know, he brought one or two others in, and showed them the sequence to just get a second view. Should that be in? Should that be included? Now, Alice Lowe, of course, clearly gave entirely the correct recommendation and said she was absolutely of the view that it would go in. King would ultimately agree with her, and it made the final cut of the film, and Paddington 2 would lock down at 104 minutes, but there had been a drive just to try and make it even shorter at that point. I mean, we're in an era where, you know, family films, the Sonic the Hedgehog 2 has just come out at the time I'm recording this. That runs to over 2 hours. And that's a film that could use 10, 15 minutes taking out, I would suggest. Paddington 2 feels very lean, but also there was a real drive just to try and make it even leaner. So the build-up to the release was going. I mean, the trailers were coming out. The promotion was underway. This was one of those instances where Studio Canal invited a bunch of journalists as well to see footage, an uncompleted film, but to see scenes from the movie just to get a flavour of it. They laid on the jam sandwiches for it too. And the general feeling was already building up that this was going to be something really quite special. That the film's premiere was earmarked for November the 5th, 2017. In London, ahead of the broader release on the 10th of November 2017. But there was a problem brewing elsewhere in the world, because whilst the UK release was sorted and most territories in the world knew when they were going to get Paddington 2, there was a problem when it came to America, because by this stage, the scandal engulfing the Weinstein Company, in particular surrounding now convicted rapist Harvey Weinstein, well, it was affecting the slate of films that the Weinstein Company was looking to put out, to the point where the Weinstein Company as a going concern was troubled, let's just say that, and it was passing on films that it had previously looked to distribute. And so the rights for Paddington 2 in America were now back up for sale fairly late in the day as well. And in the end, it was Warner Brothers who snapped up the movie, paying some $30 million for the privilege as well to distribute the film in America. But what it didn't have was the run-up to a release in time that a Warner Brothers studio movie would need. That the promotions had been going for a little while in the UK, but Warner Brothers, because it snapped up the film relatively late and needed, 3 months or so to distribute and market it in the US, it meant that Paddington 2 was not going to be released in America in 2017, and thus would not qualify for the Academy Awards in 2018 either. Furthermore, Warner Brothers would earmark a release for the movie in a relatively off-peak period in the US, that it would follow in early 2018 in America, and certainly not in the high season that the British release came along. And let's just say that would go on to have a bit of an impact. Still, there was the small matter of the release in most other territories in the world. And so the film duly went before critics. And I would imagine you know the story here. To say the reviews for Paddington 2 were ecstatic would be no understatement whatsoever. That there was a feeling that not just this was an absolutely delightful family movie, but also it was an upgrade on the already hugely loved original film. And there was a sense that this was exceptionally special. Not just getting rave reviews, but really, really, really a kind of lightning in a bottle moment. And so that response grew. The word of mouth grew. It came out in UK cinemas and just hit big. It opened with £8.3 million in the UK in its opening weekend. That outgrossed the first film as well. And it was Studio Canal's highest grossing opening weekend in the UK to that point. What was particularly impressive about Paddington 2 as well was that it held its audience right over the Christmas period, even against, in the UK, it was up against things like Justice League and films like that. But the response in the UK was very, very, very strong. And in particular, Hugh Grant was regarded as a revelation, that his performance, where he just lampoons himself, really, was getting huge, huge praise, not least the post-credit sequence. But still, you look at Paddington 2, there are very few people in that you could say put even the slightest microbe of a paw wrong. And the film was a delight. The film was getting these rave reviews. And so with award season coming round, it was expected that, well, this, at least this would be in some degree of contention. And yet, in one of the most stunning oversights of recent times, circumstances worked against Paddington 2 here. Now, it should be noted, in the UK, the film only got 3 BAFTA nominations. I don't think awards are the be-all and end-all of a movie, to be clear, but I still find it particularly baffling that a film that is as revered as this one is now was pretty much passed over by the bodies who apparently tell us what the best films were. So of its 3 BAFTA nominations, it lost the lot. It lost Best British Film to 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, for instance. Hugh Grant didn't win his BAFTA either. But also, the film didn't qualify for the Academy Awards. The Academy Awards it could qualify for were the year after, by which point it was bizarrely completely out of mind, and Paddington 2 would get not a single Oscar nomination, which, again, awards not the be-all and end-all, and I think that says more about the Oscars than it does about the film. Warner Brothers finally released the movie in the weekend of January the 12th to the 14th, 2018, and it opened in America, get this, in seventh place with an $11 million opening weekend. The films that, I mean, the Liam Neeson action film, The Commuter, opened that same weekend, got $13 million for third place. Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle was top of the chart and had been for a while. Other films around at that point, well, Proud Mary opened just below it. That was the other big opener that weekend. But Star Wars Episode 8, The Last Jedi, was in sixth. The Greatest Showman was hanging around in fourth. Steven Spielberg's The Post was in second place. Darkest Hour, Pitch Perfect 3, all of those were hanging around the chart as well. That Paddington 2 would never really claw its way to any kind of US box office success. That in its second week in US cinemas, and again, the reviews were similarly strong, it was still holding in sixth or seventh place, but films like 12 Strong came along, Den of Thieves came along, and were comfortably outgrossing it. And within like about a month, really, it had just gone. Dropped out of the top 10, and it would end up in America with, what, $40 million to its name, compared to the rest of the world, where it was a sizable hit, although, again, not of a Disney-scale hit, that it would take nearly $200 million elsewhere around the planet. Paddington 2 would end up with a gross of $228 million worldwide, but also it would end up with a reputation and a half that just continues to grow. So it pretty much goes without saying this has been a huge DVD, Blu-ray streaming hit as well. But then little stories just start to come up about it. So you might have heard the one, I think it was summer of 2020 or early 2021, when it was revealed that Paddington 2 was the best film of all time, according to Rotten Tomatoes. Now, I count Rotten Tomatoes in the same category of the Oscars, that I think it's a very flawed rating system, but still, it was the closest that service could identify to a perfect film. With, I think in the end, it had a 100% perfect rating there for a while. I think it's knocked down to 99%, but it eclipsed Citizen Kane on there as the best film of all time. But it's the word of mouth more than the algorithms, really. I went to see the Nicolas Cage movie, The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent, a few weeks ago, and there's Nicolas Cage watching Paddington 2 and loving Paddington 2 in that film. And it is the kind of movie, a rare movie to cover on a podcast like this, where it is very, very hard, not that I look for them, to find someone who's got a bad word to say about it. I'm not looking for people who've got a bad word to say about it. I do actually think it is a flat-out masterpiece and one of my 50, in my life, one of the 50 best films ever made, certainly towards the top echelons of that list as well. Now, there were plans to go for a Paddington 3 relatively soon after that, but then global pandemic matters sort of got in the way there. And also, Paul King was again umming and ahhing. Would he return for a Paddington 3? And this time he opted not to, that he felt he'd taken it as far as he could. I mean, how do you top the second one? And instead, he moved on to direct the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory prequel Wonka for Warner Brothers instead, again working with Simon Farnaby on that. Studio Canal pressed ahead with a Paddington television series, but now at the point this has been recorded in May of 2022, Paddington 3 is finally set to go before the cameras towards the end of this year, bringing most of the key creatives back together. It has a job and a half to match what the second and the first one did. But the fact that they're taking their time and the fact that they're clearly putting in the shift to get it right, I can't help but feel this is a series in very safe hands. Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. And so I've got a few parish notices before we get to the second of the two films I'm going to talk about. First and foremost, if you like this podcast and want to support this podcast, God love you, there are three ways to do so. If you go to patreon.com/Simon Brew and support us there and just chuck a few quid into the pot, that money generally goes to paying new writers for our website and giving people who've not had a writing break before a chance to get some paid work. It also goes into the materials to help produce this podcast as well. If you sign up, you get virtually every episode of the podcast early. You also find out what we're up to ahead of time as well. And there are some announcements on the way that are getting agonizingly close. You will find out about them first at Patreon, including some that require the purchase of tickets, and you will get advanced chances to do so there. You can also, if you wouldn't mind, subscribe to this podcast. That really helps, and ideally leave a hugely positive review. I'm indebted to the many people who have done that, and it helps, you know, basically independents like me get noticed amongst, let's just say, a very crowded podcast field. At the point this has been recorded, I've got a live show in Birmingham on the 18th of May, 2022. More details on that on the Film Stories website, filmstories.co.uk. I'm also about to start shipping issue 33 of Film Stories magazine, which leads with a huge exclusive interview with Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode about their decision to leave the BBC and their Wittertainment programme and launch Kermode and Mayo's Take instead. That's available to order now at store.filmstories.co.uk. But without further ado, because I feel I've plugged too much there, I'm going to move on to the second of the two films I'm talking about in this episode. I'm staying with family movies. In fact, I'm staying with hit family movies as well. This time, let's go back to 1993. I'll play you a clip. I'll come to the story of this one, the other side of this.
Hello, I'm Euphigenia Doubtfire, dear. It's homework time.
You can't imagine what it was like being married to Daniel.
He sounds like an absolute stallion.
Daddy.
Hello, dear!
Oh! Mayday!
Robin Williams. A man who'd do anything.
Back off!
Got it, Tommy.
To see his kids.
Oh!
Mrs. Doubtfire.
My first day as a woman. I'm getting hot flashes.
Sorry, that was a clip from the trailer for 1993's Mrs. Doubtfire, directed by Chris Columbus, screenplay credited to Randy Mayhem Singer and Leslie Dixon, based on Anne Fine's book Madame Doubtfire, and starring Robin Williams, Sally Field, Pierce Brosnan, Harvey Fierstein and Robert Prosky amongst its ensemble. And so let's start with Anne Fine, a British author who was walking around shops in the UK in the mid-1970s. And as she told the Veronica Asks blog, she went into a shop and was having a browse around, was introduced to the owner of that shop. And the owner of that shop was someone called Madame Doubtfire. And that name stuck. to the point where when she was fashioning a story in the mid-1980s that would ultimately be published in 1988, and she was writing a novel about a man who disguised himself as a female housekeeper to stay in touch with his children, the name Doubtfire was firmly in her head, and the book would be published as Madame Doubtfire, and it would interest Hollywood relatively early on as well. And so there was some interest, but it was a pair of producers called Frank Levy and Matthew Rushton, and it's David Scoff who explains this in his excellent biography of Robin Williams that's available now. And Levy and Rushton in turn took the project to United Artists to see if they were interested in setting it all up. And there was an executive at United Artists called Elizabeth Gabler. Now, Gabler would soon leave United Artists. This sounds like a LinkedIn profile at the moment, doesn't it? And move across to 20th Century Fox. And Madame Doubtfire was one of the projects she took with her. Writing had been getting underway. The first draft or two wasn't really working, but there was stuff to send out and stuff that people could read. Not that Anne Fine, the original author, was involved with that. Again, going back to the Veronica Ass blog, she just said she didn't really get involved with the film. She said, I don't really like working with other people much, so I left the whole thing to the filmmakers, but she had a single request. She said, I asked, was that they did not make the children bratty, and she admitted they did indulge me in that. Now, separately, Robin Williams, I mean, his career was heading north at this point. Films like Good Morning Vietnam, Dead Poets Society had earned him big box office and also Oscar nominations. He'd voiced the genie in Aladdin, and he was on the lookout for interesting projects. But also, along with his then wife, Marcia Garces Williams, they'd set up a production company by the name of Blue Wolf. Now, it was Marcia who was pivotal here, that she was the one who was reading projects and trying to find stuff that Robin could do, that they could produce together. And she got wind of that it had been set up at Fox. She had a look at the script for Madame Doubtfire, and she also read the original novel. And she preferred the novel to the screenplay that she took a look at. But in part, she sensed that this might be a role for Robin Williams. When she voiced this to Fox, well, Fox nearly bit her arm off by the sounds of it. She was offered a producer role and the opportunity to oversee the writing and the rewrites of the film. The original screenplay writer was Randy Mayhem Singer. And so, I mean, Robin Williams would explain that Marcia and I thought it was an interesting way at looking at how children are dealt with in divorces. And he was talking about why this should be his production company's first movie. And he zeroed in on the fact, he said, a lot of times children are little hostages being passed back and forth. And this film uses comedy and the character to look at that. That's the whole reason I wanted to do it. And there was a lot of comedy, there was a lot of character, and so work was fully underway on developing the script. The story centering on a divorced couple, a separated couple, Miranda and Daniel, and the scripts that had been coming together would see the couple reunite at the end of the film, which would prove to be something of a point of contention. I'll come back to that shortly. Now, Marcia was dealing with the script and the rewrites whilst also bringing up her infant son, and it was a bit of a juggling act, but the project was coming together. Now, it wasn't just Robin Williams's career that was on a high at this point. Director Chris Columbus, he was having a bit of a purple patch as well, not least with 20th Century Fox, that in 1990 he directed the film Home Alone for the studio. And Home Alone, I mean, again, you might have heard of it, that had proven to be quite a success. And so he moved on from that also at Fox to write and direct the film Only the Lonely, starring John Candy. That one didn't go quite as well. Maureen O'Hara co-starred in that one, but it was quite a sweet movie and the reviews were better than the box office. But Fox wanted Columbus back for Home Alone 2. He duly turned up for Home Alone 2. And again, whilst the reviews for that one weren't as strong, it would go on to be a monster hit. And so as the search for a director for Mrs. Doubtfire came along, it became clear that Columbus was available. And this would be the missing part of the package that would give Fox the confidence to give it the green light. And Columbus would explain in the press notes of the movie, he said, I wanted to make this film because of two things. He said, first of all, it's rare to find a comedy script with an original premise that works this well. And he said, and on top of that, there was the opportunity to work with Robin, who I think is a genius. But Columbus, leaning into the fact that his successes were generally with family movies, he said, it's also a chance to move slightly away from the type of comedies I've been doing and try a more sophisticated adult comedy. With Columbus on board, Fox was happy. It got Robin Williams, it got a script, it had got Chris Columbus. The green light was duly given. The production budget for this one wasn't going to be massive either, $25 million, although Blue Wolf Productions would get a back end on that were the film to go off and be a monster hit. There was rewrite work, though, that needed to be done. And so, again, the point of contention was, does this couple get back together at the end or not? And in fact, Randy Mayhem Singer left the film in the end when Fox was fairly insistent that they wanted to change the ending so that the couple did get back together. Leslie Dixon had been asked by the studio to come in and revise the script and do a bit of rewrite work. And this battle would be ongoing throughout the production of the film. But it got to a point where it was nearly ready to go. So there were other bits of casting. I mean, one of the key roles in the film actually is a very young one, that the young character, the youngest daughter of the Hillard family, who goes by the name of Natalie. Well, that would end up as a two-way battle between two very young performers at that stage, Mara Wilson and Blake Lively, both then infant actors. And they got down to the final two for the role. And the key was they both had to audition opposite Robin Williams. And it was Mara Wilson that prevailed. And Mara Wilson's written a terrific memoir as well, where she talks about the joy of working with Robin Williams. And Blake Lively's audition didn't quite go as well. But she's talked of that more recently as well, about just that wasn't a good time at that particular moment. Elsewhere in the cast, Chris Columbus was very, very keen to bring in Sally Field to play Miranda opposite Robin Williams. And then a relative unknown, at least on the big screen at that stage, a man called Pierce Brosnan was brought in to play Stu. Now, designing the look of Mrs. Doubtfire was going to be tricky. And Chris Columbus would talk about how the production team went through hundreds of photographs of old women to determine just what Robin Williams's alter ego should look like on film. And in the end, the one they zeroed in on was a 1940s era snap of a British woman that they used really as the guidance for the character that they would fashion. Separately, the film also needed a sequence of animation that they were going to use at the start. That the character of Daniel Hillard, played by Robin Williams, is a voiceover artist and he's voicing a cartoon. And animation legend Chuck Jones was brought in to do that. If you're not familiar with Chuck Jones's work, I mean, what a treat you've got to uncover there. And so he was hired to put together that animated film that we see at the start of the film. As it turns out, though, he'd make two versions of it, the one that we get in the movie and one that he felt was more to his style. But still, everything was moving here. The camera and makeup tests were underway, and on the 22nd of March 1993, production began on Mrs. Doubtfire. Now, it's worth noting that this was going to be fairly fast-paced, that the release date was earmarked for November 1993. They had 8 months start to finish to complete the movie, but again, no special effects on this one. This was all in camera, this was all practical, and a lot of the work had been done in the prep on this. They'd made the decision to shoot the movie entirely in San Francisco, which meant exteriors of houses in and around the area. I'm coming to that because there's a law case coming up there. But also they needed effectively to build their own little film studio there. And so what they discovered was an old sweets warehouse, which they converted into a studio where they put 5 sound stages on it. They'd originally, in earlier drafts of the film, been looking to shoot in Chicago, but they settled on San Francisco, and they used the neighbourhoods in Pacific Heights and North Beach area as well for some of the exteriors of the houses. Now, the film hinged really on how convincingly they could transform Robin Williams into the Mrs. Doubtfire character, and that required makeup that was specially designed for the film by Greg Canham. Now, Canham had won an Academy Award for Bram Stoker's Dracula and then moves on to Mrs. Doubtfire. V. Neill was heading up the makeup team. They'd worked on Beetlejuice, would go on to work on Ed Wood with Tim Burton as well. And what Williams had to have applied every day was 8 overlapping foam latex appliances with the makeup put on top of that. So this was a 4.5-hour job in the early days of the film's production, that he would have to be in the makeup chair for that amount of time to complete the transformation. In all, on the shoot of Mrs. Doubtfire, he would spend 41 days in costume as the character. So 41 times he had to sit through that. And whilst as the production went on, it got quicker to do the makeup, the quickest they managed to do it was still a 3-hour stretch in the makeup chair. Now, what they also needed then is, once he was out of the makeup chair, they needed the energy of Robin Williams, and boy, did they get it. Now, Chris Columbus knew what he was working with here, and he knew he had a very improvisational actor and wanted to let him improvise. In fact, he was open to letting all of the cast improvise, really. It's quite telling that when the film eventually got a DVD release, I think there was about nearly an hour of extra footage, and that's just the stuff that they let us see, really. There's a whole lot more, presumably, sitting in cans somewhere. Columbus was using multiple cameras to shoot a comedy, which isn't always usual, but some of the cameras he wanted trained on the supporting cast just so he could get the reaction shots, that he knew that improvisational material was going to come out, and he wanted this to look organic. He wanted to catch natural reactions to how people were dealing with what Robin Williams was coming out with. So the way Columbus would approach this was, he would shoot the scene as written a couple of times, and then he would just let everyone go for it, really. I mean, shooting days on the film would run for about 10 hours at a time. And for Robin Williams, I mean, he was, apart from the chore of the makeup, he was enjoying it. He said the joy of the role was getting to play someone totally unlike myself. And he explained, and this is in David Scoff's biography of Robin Williams, he said, it isn't just drag. It's the fact that it was like to have this character that really had a life of her own. No longer does it look anything like myself, and you're free to be this woman and create her and make her as funny as you can, but still be in character. But the continual point of contention here was the ending. And there was a real strength of feeling that for the film to work and for the film to stack up, the characters at the end, the two lead characters, had to be separate. They couldn't get back together. So this is the point where I'm heading into spoiler territory, which I try not to do too often on this podcast. But if you've not seen Mrs. Doubtfire, this is like the next 2 minutes you might want to skip. Because the debate was ongoing. Fox wanted them to reunite because that's a conventional movie story. However, it was Marcia Gay Williams who pointed out that everybody, our managers, our agents, people at the studio, said that the audience would want Daniel and Miranda to get back together, or at least to leave their situation up in the air. But she said, when two people are harmful and wrong for each other, they do not belong together. And they were she was absolutely insistent they couldn't get back together. And Chris Columbus was absolutely on the same page that for the film to work, they couldn't get back together. And in the end, the ending that they went with in the movie, they didn't get back together. And in fact, the speech that Robin Williams in character gives at the end of the movie was one that was reworked. And he, in turn, also rewrote parts of two. In fact, Williams, throughout the production, was refining lines and his character, not least in some of the courtroom speeches that are given as well. And getting the tone of this right was clearly quite crucial there. He also warmed to working with his young cast. And there's a lovely story that Lisa Jacob, who plays his eldest daughter in the film, because of the length of production of the movie, was expelled from her school for spending too much time away and working on the movie. Williams personally intervened in this, that he wrote a letter to the principal of her school appealing and just saying she should be let back in. The story goes that the principal didn't let her back in, but framed the picture and put it on their wall anyway. Production would wrap up on Mrs. Doubtfire on the 1st of July 1993. So this one had been shooting for just over 3 months, and there was a lot of work to do in the edit room, primarily because there was a lot of footage to work through. And because of the level of improvisation that had been allowed on set, Chris Columbus really had a lot of options here, because not least that he could fashion a cut with any possible rating that the Motion Picture Association of America had to offer. That Williams had done so many takes that if he wanted to do an adult R-rated version, that was an option. If he wanted to do a completely profanity-free G-rated version, that was an option. But of course, they zeroed in towards a family-friendly PG-13 in the end. Now, Columbus has talked about the fact that there is harder edge material out there, and that he would be open to exploring that in a future documentary about the movie. But for the time being, this is the version that we got. However, the rating story in particular around Mrs. Doubtfire came in the UK, and I'm indebted to my colleague Mark Harrison for digging this one up, because it caused something of a furore when it came to Britain. So the UK release of the film was in early 1994, and UK ratings are governed by the British Board of Film Classification, which had 5 years previous introduced a 12 certificate for the first time. This was to accommodate Tim Burton's Batman movie that lots of people wanted to watch. And so a 12 was introduced at that point, but it was a very strong 12. You couldn't allow anyone under 12 years old to go to the film. Now, over time, the BBFC would introduce for cinemas a 12A. Now, this wouldn't come for about another 8 or 9 years. And a 12A means if you're under 12, you're accompanied by an adult. But at this point in time, a 12 meant if you're under 12, you just weren't going in. So Fox wanted a PG certificate for the film. He felt it had a big, broad family comedy here, and that's what he wanted a certificate to reflect. And so when you submit your film to classification for the BBFC, you can say what certificate you're going for. But the BBFC came back with a 12. It denied Fox its PG, and it cited the sexual references in the movie that I won't obviously be mentioning on this very, very family-friendly podcast. However, Fox appealed this to the point where the BBFC eventually published its ruling on it, and it put out a press release. And the notoriously strict head of the British Board of Film Classification at the time was a man called James Furman, and he zeroed in on three lines that were unacceptable at the PG level, which were a reference to a sex toy, a reference to oral sex, and a reference to sexually transmitted diseases, that he felt, even though those references might not be picked up by children, they were in the film, and he couldn't let that, in a world where the Daily Mail exists, you couldn't let that go through with a PG certificate. He said that they would have to be cut to avoid getting a 12 certificate, and so Fox in the end decided not to cut it, release the film into UK cinemas with a 12. But then the BBFC was deluged with complaints from parents about this. They wanted to take their kids to see the film. Why couldn't they see it? It'd been this monster hit in America, which I'll come to in a second. And so Fox appealed again, and unusually, it altered the film while it was in cinemas, that the film would then be trimmed by 13 seconds to get a PG certificate three, four months after its original release. Now, just to confuse this again, and again, I'm grateful to Mark Harrison for this, it had gone from a 12 to a PG, but when the DVD release of Mrs. Doubtfire came around, it went back up to a 12 again. It's a little bit of a yo-yo case, this. However, one thing that was clear, even if you couldn't like get to the bottom of quite what the appropriate rating for the film was that Mrs. Doubtfire was a monster hit. I mean, at this point, the biggest hit of Robin Williams' career, the kind of level he wouldn't, just commercially at least, he would reach again, that this was playing very much to his particular comedy, to his star appeal. It opened in first place in the US on November the 26th to the 28th, 1993. It knocked the brilliant Addams Family Values off the top of the chart. $20.4 million was huge at the time. The other films opening that week were We're Back, A Dinosaur Story, which had been an animation that had been designed to capitalise on Jurassic Park. That was in 7th with $3.7 million. The excellent Clint Eastwood, Kevin Costner movie, A Perfect World, opened with $8 million in third place. But Mrs. Doubtfire was going to be the hit of the season. And, I mean, it just lived at the top of the box office chart for most of the season, really. A couple of films came along to knock it down, but they didn't hang around long. Wayne's World 2, The Pelican Brief. Mrs. Doubtfire would sit in the top three for weeks. It would reclaim the top spot at the end of the year. And by the time Mrs. Doubtfire was done in American cinemas, well, its box office was $219 million in the US alone. Unusually as well, this was a comedy that travelled. At this point, American comedies weren't matching their US grosses outside of America. This one did. Another $222 million was added to the coffers. A testament to Robin Williams' global star appeal. And the worldwide gross of the film would come in at $441 million before it went off to make an absolute mint on video and then DVD and such like. There was still a little bit of legal afters, that the owner of one of the houses where the film had shot in San Francisco was not a happy bunny at all, and complained about the way the film crew had treated their home, to the point where they took legal action, saying the crew had spoiled the house by letting children and animals run wild in there. It's not clear quite how that legal action ended up, but they saw a bit of a slice of the money there, presumably, and had a go. Two people who were getting a healthy back end off the back of this were Marsha Gaces Williams and Robin Williams through their production company. They were entitled to royalties for the movie, and unusually, Fox paid these very, very quickly. I mean, there are often stories around Hollywood of profit shares and back end deals that you have to wait years for in order for studio accounting to do its work and total everything up. Fox wanted to work with Williams again, and it got the checks out to him quickly. Really, really quickly, in fact. Fox paid these advances at great speed for what would be a gigantic hit. There was, over time, talk of doing a Mrs. Doubtfire sequel. And in fact, the critical response to the original had been okay, really, but the audience response had really just kind of taken it into the stratosphere. But still, it took a little bit of time for sequel development to start. It was 2001 where it was first said that Mrs. Doubtfire 2 was going into development, or some degree of work was going on it. But no one could find a script that they were particularly happy with, that Williams was open to the idea of returning, but needed to be happy with what was on the page. And so a late 2007 release date was eventually abandoned for it, although it wasn't officially announced. And the idea of Mrs. Doubtfire 2 was scrapped at one point in 2006. It then resurrected four or five years later with more script work going on. And the interviews were a bit up and down on this. One time Williams would say it was happening, another time he wouldn't. In 2014, Chris Columbus would in turn state that they are now talking about doing a full sequel to Mrs. Doubtfire, that Fox was interested in doing that. But of course, tragedy would strike in August of 2014 when Williams's life came to an end in awful circumstances, really, and the world very keenly still feels his loss. And understandably, in the immediate aftermath of that, the idea of Mrs. Doubtfire 2 was quietly retired. What there has been instead has been a Broadway musical, which finally opened after an assortment of pandemic delays in December 2021. But in terms of film, Mrs. Doubtfire pretty much stands alone and is likely to always stand alone. Because let's face it, who would even think about stepping into Robin Williams' outfit for this one? It turned into one of the biggest family hits of the 1990s, but there's no box set for this one. Which brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I have not bored the socks off you, you can find more on me at Twitter at Simon Brew. You can find more from our entire Film Stories project with its multiple strands at Film Stories Pod. So we're on Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, YouTube, youtube.com/filmstories. You will find our website at filmstories.co.uk, and that's updated every weekday with movie news, with reviews, with features, with an assortment of bits and bobs there. If you head to store.filmstories.co.uk, we now have 42 issues of print magazines, some of which are sold out, but across our Film Stories magazine and our Film Junior magazine for younger film fans, they're all available to buy now, along with our Sneakers Blu-ray with special extras that we've put together for that. And then there are more things coming, which I will be talking about hopefully in the next couple of episodes. We're coming close to episode 250, you know, it's been quite a journey this. But for now, as always, I thank you so much for your time and I thank you for listening. Look after yourselves. You all take care. I'm going to be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Bye bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, it seems I didn't need the West End after all.
Just
a captive audience. What am I like?
Guards, lock me up.
The weight you have.